Start. You want me to start?
I can.
Okay, and I'll just kind of jump in and whatever.
I can start. Are we recording?
Yes, but it can be edited out.
I can't see the red light that, on air, off air. I can't see that. And now this is now this part of the conversation is going to make it to the bloopers, and that's going to be
You have access. Have
an
access.
interesting podcast of its own. All right, so getting into this here. This is Razor's Kiss and Brigand here for the podcast edition of the Choosing Hats blog that we're affectionately calling Hat Tricks. Hopefully, through the course of this podcast, we'll be able to give you some tips and tricks on in your apologetic encounters. And this particular podcast, we're going to be attempting to identify and counter different kinds of just bad arguments that you're going to be presented with by an unbeliever in the course of your general apologetics. These are kinds of arguments that the average Joe will be presenting to you, and not necessarily the super apologists of whichever group you're going to be dealing with. So we want to bring up these issues because these bad arguments that we're going to be presenting are a really good way to waste your time considerably. These sorts of arguments are designed to lead you to follow down various rabbit trails and distract you from addressing target and core issues. What we want to do in apologetics is we want to keep the main thing the main thing. What these bad arguments do that we are often presented with is make it difficult to keep those core issues front and center with just things that are impossible, lists of things to be able to address exhaustively. And these kinds of arguments are really about who tires out first. And we want to be able to address these things very quickly without without just simply brushing them off as though the person we're dealing with has nothing of value to say at all. So we have several kinds of arguments that we've grouped into different categories, and hopefully you'll be able to see and apply some of these things to your own encounters. Tell us a little bit about what kinds of arguments are out there.
Well, first we have the shotgun arguments, is what I call them. Also called scattershot or rapid fire. There's all kind of different names for them. We'll get into that a little bit. Popularity arguments, where you're just arguing about whether something's more popular than whether position A is more popular than position B. Why it's more popular, in what way it's more popular, and you can argue that ad infinitum, but that's just a bad argument. Another one is unargued assertions, where you just say that's just the way it is, but you don't give any reason why it is. You just say it is. Well, give me an argument. The next one is the modernity argument, where if it's newer, it's better. That might work with some models of cars, but doesn't necessarily work with apologetic encounters from either side. Next one is pretended neutrality, saying that, well, we just have to start from a neutral standpoint. I mean, if we don't start from a neutral standpoint, I mean, we're just going to argue in circles, won't we? Well, that's not the case. And most of the time, it's a pretended neutrality because either side's really neutral. Then the next one is the arguments, everything violent is caused by religion, typically, is the argument you'll see most often. And then misrepresentation, also called straw man, but, you know, there's different forms of misrepresentation. We can get into all of those. You got anything to add to that?
I'm sure there's an entire list of just bad arguments that people can throw at you. So tell us a little bit about kinds of shotgun arguments you'd encounter.
One I actually encountered just recently, in fact, earlier today, someone was saying that the messianic prophecies weren't reliable and on and on and on, but just real rapid fire. Which of the two kingdoms during Jesus' lifetime that were abandoned? Who dreaded the kingdom of Israel during the first century when there had not been a kingdom of Israel in existence since the 7th century BCE? When did Jesus eat cream and honey? Well, to just spit them right out. Well, those questions take a lot of context and a lot of information to answer, but it only took 30 seconds to throw those out there. Well, if you have to spend, you know, five times the amount of time that they did to offer the objection, and really, that's not really an objection, that's just asking a bunch of questions. But just answering the questions, knowing what's going to happen, knowing what they have in mind behind it, isn't necessarily what the issue is. You had something to add?
Yeah, it's those kinds of arguments make me wonder if they're really making an objection, or, you know, it's kind of like a trivia hunt.
Yeah. Well, they'll fire these rapid objections. They're just rapid fire, one after the other after the other. And they're usually over like a wide range of topics. What's problematic about that it wants you to, on the pain of them claiming victory, which is usually what happens when this starts, to answer all these objections, well, they do one of several things. You can, one, just buy their time and assemble the next series of rapid-fire objections. Or two, as you answer one, follow it up before you're able to answer the next. Or three, just so utterly waste your time in what are necessarily longer answers than the objections that they gave you. They wear you out, put you out of commission, or just try to make you look ignorant.
Are they even listening to the answer when they make a whole bunch of rapid fire questions?
I very much if you watch Dan Barker's first debate with Dr. White, he just fires back all these supposed contradictions and just ba-boom, 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 therefore God does not exist after each one. Well, as Dr. White pointed out in the debate, the logical grounds that all these objections were supposedly based on would also result in, because Dan Barker preached Christ at one point, and then he no longer preaches Christ, well, Dan Barker doesn't exist. So, I mean, a lot of the time, the objections themselves don't even make sense. It's just throwing out so many of them that you just don't have time to answer. There really are solutions to that, though. The first one I've found is just go one by one. Say, wait, 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 wait. I can't answer seven questions at once. Let's go one at a time. Make them wait for your answer before they ask anything else. And really, preferably, want them to interact with your answer.
Right. When I encounter those kinds of questions, the first thing I want to do is I want to set the groundwork. If they're really interested, I will let them ask their best question, and that will be the framework in which I work. That'll be at least a starting point to move the conversation back into, or at least ground the conversation in that one topic, as opposed to, you know, you were saying, all these very broad categories, which are going to be really hard to wrestle with. You can't juggle that many that many things all at once, and neither can they. And that's a that's equally a problem for them, because they can't. You're not going to be able to process all that information all at once.
Yeah, I was just about to say the other way you can handle that is just to fire back a rapid fire series at them and have them try and do it and say, now look, this is what you wanted me to do. Can you do this? If you can't do it, how do you expect me to? Let's pick one at a time. You know, it mostly just goes back to common sense stuff. I mean, you know, nobody can multitask that well. It's just not possible. They can't demonstrate the ground of their objection, which is another one. If you make them demonstrate the grounds of their objection, then they can't just throw out all these arguments one after another. But we'll actually discuss a little bit more about that later. Hinted at it at the beginning of the show.
And that's a good question to when they're forced to demonstrate the grounds. That brings it back to a relevant topic. You know, again, with all these broad categories, it's really distracting from a core issue. And some questions like without further context, like your question of when did Jesus eat cream and honey? That's a question that without any context, that has no relevance to anything.
Yeah, it's like, when did the red bird fly west at dawn? Well, what?
It's like, what are you talking about here? So these are all things that detract from the main conversation that you're trying to have.
Yes. I think you had another one you wanted to look at. Arguments from popularity. How would you address that? And what would one of those look like?
There's several different kinds of popularity arguments. It's all in all, it's just a counting noses, kind of argumentation. So you could be counting any number of things, but it all has to do with popularity. And sadly enough, some of these ways of counting popularity work against each other, but they're all being used. So one of these ways is to appeal to the sources that you've read or mostly actually that you're familiar with. Well, in all the books that I've read, they all say this, and they posit a truth claim. Well, the problem with that is that most people tend to read within their sphere of influence. They haven't canvassed the entire library or canvassed academia to research their topic. They're familiar with the kinds of books that they enjoy to read. Another one is an appeal to the popularity over history. Both the Catholics and Eastern Orthodox people will appeal to the popularity of history. Well, our faith has had the majority of people believing it for the greatest number of years.
Years of church history.
We've had 2,000 years of church history. How can we possibly be wrong when Protestantism is a mere 500 years old? You're just a baby. You have no theological development whatsoever. Of course, the problem with this is that's not an honest evaluation. It's simply an assumption that this is what we believe now, what we have always believed. Of course, the more you dig into history, the more you find that what people believe might change from year to year. It might be popular in one century to have transubstantiation. It might be very unpopular the very next century. And of course, that has been established in the course of the history of the Roman Catholic Church. That it doesn't always hold up. Yeah. Not to say the least, of course, the assumption is that they have always been, and that's another argument. But that's still their appeal, is that 2,000 years, we have the greatest number of time, as though time, proves something in and of itself. It doesn't at all. We can also count the number of experts. And it's an appeal to some kind of authority. The global warming issue recent news has sparked a lot of controversy in this area, because that's been the overwhelming appeal, is that the majority of scientists agree with the global warming claims.
But now that that's being questioned a little bit, whether that's actually a majority belief, or whether the data that they're believing on the basis of is sound,
or whether they've investigated, or whether all these people who agree have even investigated or read, or just simply noted their, these are all questions that that could be unpacked. But the claim itself, appealing to the majority of people or a majority of experts, isn't a valid argument. And of course, there's also the popularity in general. Well, the majority of people currently believe in evolution. Well, because it's being taught in schools or whatnot. Whatever the majority belief is, must therefore be true. To sum it up, all these arguments only work if you have a relative view of truth to begin with, and that the answer to any particular investigation of a truth claim is subject to something as simple as a democratic vote. You know, is the answer to 2 + 2 going to change based on how many people believe it to be true, or how many experts are polled, or that people in the majority of history has believed something otherwise? Not at all. And so these popularity arguments, mostly appeal to the emotions, because we always want to be on the side of the majority. It feels more comfortable to go with the flow, go with the masses. But you don't have to look too much further than social theory. That there's something interesting that happens when people form a mob, is that they don't always act very rationally at all. So tell us a little bit about assertions that people make without arguing their claims.
Well, many critics, they'll tell you, all right, let me give you an argument. But it isn't an argument. It's just an assertion. They don't actually argue their point. They just throw out some factoid. But they expect you to respond with no context given, no premises given, and no data to work with. Like our, when did Jesus eat curds and honey? Well, okay. Well, it's great if you throw out, when did Jesus eat curds? What are you talking about? You know, can you give me the verse? Can you give me why you think this is a problem, and why you're even asking me this as an objection? You know, a lot of times those are used for gotchas. Well, that's kind of like asking, you hear on all these detective shows, ask them some penetrating leading question. Well, it was a trick question, and that alone gets them the a conviction. And well, that might work in on Matlock, but it doesn't usually work anywhere else. Like, when people say, like earlier, I was arguing with someone who was saying there's a discrepancy in the genealogical accounts of Jesus. That was it. Well, where? Well, don't you know about this? Like, I'm not going to make an argument for you. I mean, I understand that you think there's an objection here, but why don't you lay it out so I know what you're actually objecting to? I mean, we aren't here to argue their case as well as ours. I mean, you may know what they're referring to, but make them argue their case. So you're not arguing against a straw man because you're the only one building anything. We should be familiar enough with the best argument made from that position to be able to do so, with study and with time. But you'll find, especially in the internet age, people go to the Skeptic's Annotated Bible and just copy-paste, throw it out there. Well, doesn't work so well that way, because if they don't know what they're talking about, if they just copied and pasted and didn't read, the surrounding context, I mean, there's some nonsense on the Skeptic's Annotated Bible and on infidels.org and all kind of places. They might just be spouting factoids they read on the internet once. Well, I read on the internet at this one place that this one guy said that the Bible contradicts itself.
I read it on the internet, therefore...
Okay, I read it on the internet.
If they read it on the internet once, okay, that's great, but where does it contradict itself? Well, it brings up the obvious reminder. If they don't know, that's fine. Point that out. Bring it to its logical conclusion that, well, since you don't know what you're objecting about, it's not really an objection, obviously. But if you don't know the answer, and if they are actually objecting, don't pretend to know if you don't, because we're the ones who are called to a higher standard. Just tell them, you know what? I don't know the answer to that one. Let me get back to you. There's nothing wrong with saying that. There's everything to do with pride in saying you know something when you don't. That's pride compounded with arrogance, compounded with false witness. I mean, it's just bad. We can see that with several situations going on
right now. We're not playing poker here. We don't need to bluff ourselves. Because all it takes to ruin your credibility is for them to call your bluff just once.
You're up the creek without a paddle. But in either case, make them present their argument. Because whether you're ignorant of the issue raised or not, they still have to make an argument, or it isn't an objection. It's just an assertion. So that's pretty much all I got to say about that one. You wanted to talk about the modernity argument a little bit.
It's interesting that earlier I was talking about popularity arguments due to history, which is interesting because that contradicts some of the modernity arguments, that because it was true for a longer period of time, therefore it must be, this was believed for a longer period of time, where it must be true. The modernity argument works almost exactly the opposite. Whatever is the most X, Y, or Z is the truth in the matter. Whatever the current trend of science or theology or whatnot, whatever that is, that need to be viewed as true. It's the most frequent argument I've heard, particularly online, is that is more like an unargued assertion, because it's old, or because it's an old book, out of an old, therefore it must be wrong. Why? Because old people were more stupid back then than they are today. As though our SAT scores are on the rise or something, which is not true at all. That's beside the point. So where do they get the idea that the newer is clearly more true? You see in academia that people revise textbooks year after year in science or whatnot, or even in magazines. It's more like a latest fashion trend. You know, whatever is the current fashion, that is what is true and beautiful. I think the popular one from history is the idea of planetary motion, because that idea was developed, because the idea of planetary motion was developed over time, because we got a greater understanding of it over time. Therefore, this applies to everything else in the world. You know, we have a better understanding of plants. Therefore, everything old is false or less true or something in those categories. However, this doesn't apply in every category, because even in graduate school, not just in elementary school, but in graduate school, we're still reading Plato for philosophy. We're still reading Sophocles in literature. We're still reading Plutarch in history, and we still work out the Pythagorean theorem in geometry. You know, these are ancient writers, ancient authors that we presently read to gain an understanding about our present circumstances in whatever category, and we read them as though we haven't developed them much further. You know, certainly we understand more about math. Certainly there have been many philosophers. Certainly great works of literature have been written since then. However, we still go back to these to very old works of philosophy, literature, etc., to build a foundation. It's not because they're not true anymore. It's because we're building on their foundation. And the problem with modernity is that it ultimately lacks in both foresight and hindsight, because we're living in the now. Everything that we see and experience are through the lenses of our own present experience. There's an enormous amount of bias there. It's easy to look back with a great deal of criticism, but that's only because we've come through that history and have ultimately gained wisdom from that. But presently, we don't have the wisdom of our present experience yet. So the modern viewpoint that what is modern is true, what is old is false, is severely, severely lacking. Oh, really?
Yeah, I actually have a really good quote on that, if you don't mind. Yes. In Dr. White's history class, I actually quoted this in my history class I did recently, too. He has this little section right at the introduction that I thought was just spectacular. So what can a bunch of old dead guys with no cell phones or cars teach us anyway? Can folks with no conceptions of cell phones, cars, space travel, who didn't have computers, high technology, or iPods really tell us something today? Aren't we more advanced and smarter than they were? Can we really learn anything from folks in togas or from people who weren't as advanced as blessed or that didn't have access to all the resources and blessings that we have today? Well, we stand on the shoulders of giants. We stand on the accumulated knowledge of many generations that have come before us. And we look back and see what these individuals have accomplished without all the assistance that you and I have. I wonder how many of us go as far and show as much dedication, as much insight, as much brilliance as these individuals did.
Right on the money.
I thought that was excellent.
That's right on the money.
And it fit right into what you're talking about, too. I wasn't a Calvinist. Yeah. I said
the other thing about gaining knowledge over time is that the fact that we have a different view of any particular subject now is only due to that accumulated knowledge. The problem is, of course, that we've seen that it changes based on how much knowledge of something we accumulate. When we, we come to the table with more knowledge, there's several things that happen. We come to the, we can change our views. We can, due to our present circumstances, have a different bias. Any number of things. And here's the problem with not only the interpretation that's based on our bias on a subject, it's also claiming something about our knowledge, that at this point in history, now we know exhaustively about something. That's the only way that people who assume the modernity argument works, is that at this point in history, we have exhaustive knowledge. Because you won't know tomorrow whether that will hold true based on a new insight, unless you already have exhaustive knowledge. These arguments are reading truth or treating truth as not as this one will need to be edited out, but they're treating history as though, based on their judgments, history isn't merely no longer but never was true when they use modernity arguments. And I've been talking a lot about bias, and that fits right into people's hidden presuppositions. What they pretend to be neutral, but aren't really.
We were talking about Roman Catholics earlier. For instance, when they look at history, they assume that the Roman Catholic Church, as it exists today, has always existed. The majority of them. Now, once you get into the academic realm, they start to adopt Newman's development hypothesis, and, well, the germ of it all was there at the beginning, but now it's since sprouted out into the full tree and bloom and all this other stuff. But when you talk to, you know, Joe Catholic on the street, that's not what they think, because that's not what they're taught. They're taught that what you believe is what's always been believed for 2,000 years, except that when you look at history, it's not what actually happens. So, but when they tell you, well, you need to start from just a neutral position, don't just assume we're wrong. Well, wait a minute. Aren't you just assuming I'm wrong? Because you've never had any different belief, and you're descended from the apostles, right? Your pope is infallible, right? Do you ever abandon that position when you're arguing? No. That neutrality is pretended. People assume things they don't always admit, and they don't put it on the table. As presuppositionalists, we're laying out all our cards to begin with, and asking they do the same. So, you know, for another example, a materialist is objecting to something. The statement is, nothing exists except matter, but laid into the argument. Well, isn't it dishonest of him to leave that portion of his belief system off the table until that late, where you don't have a whole lot of time to go over that with him? You could have addressed that at the beginning, where it should have been addressed.
And that's the foundation of his entire world.
Because that's a presupposition.
That's his entire view of reality right there, that nothing exists except matter.
And that's the foundation of
his... And that undercuts already every argument that you make as someone defending the Christian faith based on our belief in a supernatural reality.
Exactly. Their assumption, a priori, is that the supernatural cannot exist.
That's extremely circular.
The conclusion is the supernatural cannot exist. This is begging the question.
That makes it really hard to to engage in apologetics if they have the if their entire view and their entire argument is we're just spinning our wheels with them.
Yes. Well, one thing I was noticing, I was having a discussion the other day. This person always gets upset when I use the presuppositional argumentation, using the transcendental method, or the transcendental argument. You just always go there first. You just can't stand anyone to examine your position. I said, look, I gave you my position to begin with. You're not giving yours.
Or define it.
You just think you can just, all you have to do is object. You don't ever have to defend your own position. You never have to present.
Or define it.
Yes, you don't have to present your position. But then when I ask you, what is your position, and I have to drag it out of you with 15 questions when I gave it to you all up front, well, and then you get mad at me for asking you questions when that's all you want to do to me. Well, isn't that begging the question too? What you're really telling me is, by going that route, is that you don't care what I have to say. You're just looking out to beat me up. Well, I understand, but you need to present an argument yourself. I'm not the only one who has to give an argument. And when you just make objections, usually, as we were talking about, the unargued assertions, based on what? All those things that you don't want to have examined. And it's just unbelievably circular. When you talk about assumed Unitarianism, Dr. White's gone over this a bunch in his videos and on his webcast. When Jehovah's Witnesses or modern Jews, Unitarians, Muslims, they all assume Unitarianism a priori. Everything to do with God must be Unitarian, so they read everything in Scripture in a Unitarian way. I've seen for myself a Jehovah's Witness that I was talking to you. I was sitting right next to him. Skip over the section of Isaiah 6, 30 and following. I was referring to show whose robe filled the temple. Well, he just skipped over it. Completely gone. Psalm 102, it just gone. Just parts of the verse was gone. Reading Philippians 2, gone. Colossians, gone. I mean, they just skip right by it, like right in front of me. Like they don't even read it, don't even look at it. They're bringing their finger along it. Their finger just moves and it's on to the next. It was unreal. I've never seen something like that before. But then on the other hand, we're asked to start a discussion from a neutral position, to be agnostic to what we believe in order to make our argument. That's what we're always at. We have to prove from that position that God exists. But they don't start from any such neutral position. They won't even give you what their position is, let alone be neutral. Well, we deny that you can be. You can't. They argue from their anti-biblical stance, from their materialist, naturalist, autonomous stance, but they're demanding that you join them there and to argue in the opposite direction from where they are. Well, that's the position that classical and evidentialist apologists have taken. And just think about where they're starting from. What do you think it's going to finish with? Catastrophe. All ground is God's ground, as Bunsen says. I mean, there's just no other way to do it. If you lay all your cards out on the table, you know where you're starting from. They know where you're starting from, and there's going to be no confusion and
well,
no
that's,
other problems on that
this
basis.
One, this one's a really good one because that is this
you have
one's kind
of
the,
that or did
the
I
crux of the
well, that's
presuppositionalist method is that everyone has these presuppositions, things that they assume to be true, and it doesn't matter how much you attempt to or even falsely attempt for the sake of the other person to be an objective journalist in any case. The unfortunate thing is that everybody has a dog in the race, so to speak. You are near and dear to your own position, and that's the whole reason why you're arguing it. You've got it's not merely intellectual baggage that you have a worldview. It's also compounded with emotional components, and overcoming these presuppositional hurdles, these so-called neutral, or even worse, the ones that are hidden under the surface, that we have to dig up to be able to examine their worldview, just as they're attempting to examine ours. That's the one that takes a bit of time and a bit of understanding. So this is where we'll have to series on Always Ready to get everyone more familiar with the presuppositionalist method and understanding how worldview systems are put together with presuppositions and how to argue against that. So I think Chris had a post recently with five of those podcasts put together, and I assume that eventually we'll get back to discussing that book once again, and hopefully for people listening to this podcast will become more familiar with that. Yep.
As I understand, we're going to be starting a reboot of that fairly soon, so look forward to that. I just have one more thing to add to that last topic. Right here where we're talking about there's no neutrality, that's why I don't want to present their argument for them, because I'm not going to present it like they will. I can't. I can do my best. I can try my hardest to object to form their objection the exact same way that they would, but I want them to make their objection so that I can respond to it from
right.
their own.
Yeah, we can be familiar. We can familiarize ourselves with the yes. with the
so
basic Jehovah's Witness, the basic
that's an important thing, I think.
Atheist, or the basic
right. yeah we could
Roman Catholic position. But for that individual, they're going to have to be able to express their worldview in their own terms. It's the same thing that's going to be asked of us.
All right. I think that's all we got for that topic, right? You good to go on that one? At least until we get into Always Ready. The next one we were going to talk about is,
well, it's an appeal to violence in some respect. The most common
there,
the
so
most common appeal to violence is that all wars are caused by religion. I've seen this thrown out countless times, as though nobody has ever read anything in 20th century history, which just reduces all that to ash, considering that all the greatest acts of genocide and other such violence has absolutely nothing to do with religion whatsoever. In fact, they are caused by very, very corrupt people and very, very corrupt governments. Sometimes with an appeal to religion, but not even in the 20th century that hasn't been true, unless of course you consider that Mao Zedong promoting his communist China basically started his own religion of himself. Unless you want to go that route, which you'll have to do. All wars are caused by religion. It's just it's ultimately an argument that's reduced to its simplest component. And if any war in history has ever had any sort of appeal to religion, that's what the argument's going to be reduced to in order to elevate the position. But that's completely untrue. There are religious factors of wars in history, but as to its relevance, as to its significance, and as to its primary impetus for any particular war in history, those things all have to be examined. There are many, many, many factors accompanying all the wars in history. It's not a simple case. There are social, economic, political, all kinds of factors involved in any given war. And again, I've made the reference to the popular, the famous atheist leaders in the 20th century, all have just put to shame all the kinds of deaths that have ever occurred in history. Whether you're speaking of the Inquisition or all the historical so-called stake burnings or whatever you want to appeal to, eclipsed a hundredfold with anything that's been that's made a 20th century appearance. So other ways in which these violence arguments are propagated is through the second most popular one, I think, is the Crusades argument. And of course, there's more factors to the Crusades than simply religion, although that one was definitely had very significant religious overtones. But of course, the Crusades are a much richer history than that, and it's not as though the other side, the Muslims in this case, weren't trying themselves to get a foothold in the European continent. That's what they invaded Constantinople. They invaded through Gibraltar into Spain, and it's not so that Europeans were not trying to wage a counteroffensive in any regard. There's more. It's more than a simple religious question, although it was definitely encouraged by the Roman Catholic Church. Several other arguments include an argument for Hitler, as though he was a legitimate Christian, some guy who's never been there, somehow a legitimate Christian, and because he shook hands with the Pope once or something in that regard, or made appeals to the German Church. whatever it was, somehow they believe that Hitler and his acts were consistent with biblical Christianity, which is so off the wall, it's not even funny. The newest argument that I've heard from atheists is that, it's an appeal to divine revelation that the atheists have sometimes claimed, particularly recently. I think these are mostly the new atheists, that Christians will kill anyone at any time as long as God tells them to. And that people should always be afraid of Christians because this could happen at any moment without reason or without cause, as long as they believe that God has told them to. Of course, the big problem with this is that they have no understanding of, again, a biblical Christianity that is grounded in that is grounded in the scriptures, because obviously, right off the bat, this is not how Christians operate. Christians do not operate by getting a secret divine word from God in new revelation. Our faith is grounded in what God has revealed, has made public, so to speak. God has disclosed all he wants to know, all he wants us to know about him and his will through the scriptures. And this is clearly a misunderstanding of what biblical Christianity entails altogether. And the problems with these arguments and appeals to violence is that ultimately the unbeliever doesn't have a godly moral standard to appeal to. You know, why, according to the atheist, are the Crusades wrong? Or to put it in other terms, to put it in more broad terms, why is any war justifiably immoral for any reason? And that would be a challenge to them to, you know, kind of argue their reasons for anything that has happened, and at the same time force them to attempt to find religious causes in all the wars that they think are caused by religion but really aren't. Yes. Absolutely.
Brings the main thing back to the main thing. What else I found was interesting on that one? I've actually heard them say almost exactly what you said up there. Kill anyone anytime or God tells them to without reason. Well, if their God tells them to, it's not without reason, is it? That's just assuming that God doesn't exist, so it's without reason.
And this completely overlooks,
which is an interesting model.
Again, in biblical Christianity, you have no further to look than Genesis 9 or Romans 13 or other similar passages to understand that the Christian perspective on violence is that the sword of justice belongs to the state. That this is in the authority of the government to carry out, i.e., that we don't have vengeance killings or anything like that, that anything related to capital punishment or justice in general is in the hands of our government.
that actually reminds me. Yesterday evening, I had a conversation with a homosexual woman. She was really emotional, and she was just baiting us basically because she says, "Well, do you think it's okay to just kill us?" And do you think it's okay for there to be the death penalty for homosexuality? Well, the way I answered that was, who instituted the death penalty? The government, correct? Because otherwise, it's kind of meaningless to say death penalty. It's just murder. So it'd have to be a governmental penalty for a crime of homosexuality. In that case, if it's a law, if it is a crime, if that is the penalty that the state has instituted, the state carries it out, yes, it's perfectly acceptable with God's law and with the authority that he has instituted. Well, she flipped out at that point and said, what does she call me? A sociopath. You think that we should all be killed, and you think you can kill it? Well, wait, that's not what I said. Pay attention. I said, if it's the government's law, if it's the government carrying it out, that's what is acceptable. I'm not doing anything. That's the law of the government, the law of the land, and you would be a criminal. You know, and she just would not listen and flew off the handle. But that's sometimes what you're going to get, even if you give the reasonable argument, but at least you give the right argument. Instead of just following along with,
Christianity.
I don't know about all that. No, the government has a sword.
It's assumed that we take upon ourselves.
Misunderstanding.
Carte blanche license to whatever we view just or moral or whatever, to impose it upon everyone else in such a way that we can justify ourselves in just blatant violence and murder and mayhem and whatnot. Completely untrue altogether. You know, the other common appeal is to so-called Christians who attempt to murder abortion doctors or inflict violence on abortion clinics or whatnot in the because Christians believe that the unborn is also human life and that abortion is therefore murder, that it's suddenly okay to go the vengeance route and take the law into our own hands and murder someone else. You know, that's subverting authority altogether. That's as though we say it's okay if weeks and months into the future that we happen to find the killer of our next door neighbor, that we would go out and in broad daylight pull a gun on them. Since when does that happen? Since when is that argument used against Christianity? It's not. People do take the law into their own hands, and they are severely misled and acting against the law and need to have the full force of the law carried out upon them. You want to cover that? We've been an hour already.
Misrepresentation now, so that's pretty interesting segue into that.
So what are... did you have something else? Okay, well, so tell us about misrepresentation here. In what ways are objections of... Are objections simply misrepresentation of a position, and why is that a bad argument, and how can we diffuse that?
Well, as you probably know, as we've talked about it to some extent, I really think the most common problem with objections is misrepresentation of either our position or of us personally, or of who God is, especially. I'm not going to get into that because, you know, I can get really long on that, and we're already probably pretty close to our time, but... I found there's very little study of systematic theology by most objectors. That's not saying that I require every objector to have read Hodges, Raymond's, maybe Turretin for, you know, good measure before they can object to me. But, you know, they don't really study what we believe. They think they have, but they just listen to... Well, once again, they read some things on the internet, and that must be true. There's very little study, in my experience, of context, grammar, syntax, what we actually say, historic doctrines, church history, or a host of other topics that we take as something to be examined as a matter of course. But when we point out these things, most common response, but I've heard Christians say otherwise. Well, you've heard Hitler say this, or you've seen, you know, any other kind of, you know, non-normative things happen in any position. But that doesn't mean that because there is such a thing as a non-normative position, that there's no such thing as an orthodox position. That's just ridiculous. It wouldn't be, you know, odd or out of place unless there was an orthodox position. It's like the insistence. I actually got this the other day. Marcion is a Christian. The most hated heretic in the history of the early church, perhaps the history of the church, period. I mean, the one that every book in... In the early church, everyone who was anybody wrote a book against what a heretic Marcion was, to the point that, you know, he was compared to barbarians and gnawing rodents and all kind of things because of how bad he was doctrinally. He was Gnostic.
But there was some of the respects, New Testament
was,
left. Therefore,
completely
he
anti-Jewish, ripped the entire Old Testament out, half the New Testament, anything that mentioned Judaism or Jewishness.
But there were some of them.
Yes, of course. He left part of some books. I mean, hey, he was sola scriptura what was left. What? He ripped up the entire canon just about, but. Yeah, he was sola scriptura about what he left out of all the stuff that he threw away. Really? Well, then everybody is a Christian, basically, because I'm sure everybody's heard some variant of the Golden Rule. So they believe something in the Bible, so they must be Christian. What? So when you ask him, well, on what basis is he a Christian? You can't say what basis. That's a no true Scotsman.
Many similar
fallacy.
Arguments.
I am so tired of hearing that one. How many times have you heard it? A lot? I'm sure you have. Well, you know, as Scotsman, you would think Scotsman would be authorities on what it is to be Scottish. Because know, they're from Scotland, they have Scottish ancestry, you know, it's, there's something to do with being Scottish that you kind of have to be Scottish to determine, because that's who determined what Scottish was to begin with. But, you know, but Christians, in the same way, are the authority on what it means to be a Christian, but even more pertinently, the reason we are Christians is because of the scripture that we hold to be God-breathed, infallible, and the revelation of the eternal and sovereign God who defined who we are and whose spirit lives within us. I mean,
yeah,
what
God makes
what
people
else do they
Christians,
want
but
I mean,
we're not
we
allowed
can't
to
who, we can't
look to what God has
is,
said
but they
in
can.
What determines
that's what,
a Christian
caught.
Is.
Go ahead. You want
that
to
just
say
doesn't
something.
Make any sense. Oh, right. I forgot about that part.
Well, because God doesn't exist, right? I forget that too. Because, you know, I'm supposed to be assuming that instead of what I actually do.
No, I didn't. Because yeah, we don't have any schedule lined out to say, hey,
no,
this is what's going to happen next time you see us.
I don't know how we want to wrap this up.
Or when you'll see us next time. However, hopefully some of these bad argument styles will sound familiar to you, and that you'll be able to recognize them for what they are as bad arguments. If anybody has any questions, feel free to leave us a comment on our blog. I'm sure this will have a post associated with it. So feel free to leave us a comment, ask us any question, and hopefully in a future episode or in the further and help you out in your in sharpening up your apologetics. Thank you for joining us on our first podcast here, and hopefully we'll see you back very soon, Lord willing. Thanks for joining us.
Please visit www.choosinghats.com. Recording.